Without a healthy social fabric, politics became polarized. One party came to represent the state. The other came to represent the market. One party tried to shift power and money to government. The other tried to shift those things to vouchers and other market mechanisms. Both of them neglected and ignored the intermediary institutions of civil life. In socially depleted nations, many people began to form their personal identities around their political faction. They had nothing else to latch on to. Politicians and media polemicists took advantage of the psychic vacuum and turned parties into cults, demanding and rewarding complete loyalty to the tribe. Once politics became a contest pitting one identity group against another, it was no longer possible to compromise. Everything became a status war between my kind of people and your kind of people. Even a small concession came to seem like moral capitulation. Those who tried to build relationships across party lines were ostracized. Among politicians, loyalty to the party overshadowed loyalty to institutions like the Senate or the House. Politics was no longer about trade-offs. It was a contest for honor and group supremacy. Amidst this partisan ugliness, public trust in government and political institutions collapsed. In a densely connected society, people can see the gradual chain of institutions that connect family to neighborhood, neighborhood to town, town to regional associations to national associations, and national associations to the federal government. In a stripped-down society, that chain has been broken, and the sense of connection gets broken with it. The state seems at once alien and intrusive. People lose faith in the government's ability to do the right thing most of the time and come to have cynical and corrosive attitudes about their national leaders. Instead of being bound by fraternal bonds and occasionally responding to a call for joint sacrifice, a cynical "grab what you can before the other guys steal it" mentality prevails. The result is skyrocketing public debt and a public unwilling to accept the sacrifice of either tax increases or spending cuts required for fiscal responsibility. Neither side trusts the other to hold up their end of any deal. Neither party believes the other would honestly participate in truly shared sacrifice. Without social trust, the political system devolves into a brutal shoving match. The soft side. Harold believed that the cognitive revolution had the potential to upend these individualistic political philosophies and the policy approaches that grew from them. The cognitive revolution demonstrated that human beings emerge out of relationships. The health of a society is determined by the health of those relationships, not by the extent to which it maximizes individual choice. Therefore, freedom should not be the ultimate end of politics. The ultimate focus of political activity is the character of the society. Political, religious, and social institutions influence the unconscious choice architecture undergirding behavior. They can either create settings that nurture virtuous choices, or they can create settings that undermine them. While the rationalist era put the utility-maximizing individual at the center of political thought, the next era, Harold believed, would put the health of social networks at the center of thought. One era was economocentric, the next would be sociocentric. The sociocentric intellectual currents, he hoped, would restore character talk and virtue talk to the center of political life. You can pump money into poor areas, but without cultures that foster self-control, you won't get social mobility. You can raise or lower tax rates, but without trust and confidence, companies won't form and people will not invest in one another. You can establish elections, but without responsible citizens, democracy won't flourish. After a lifetime spent designing and writing about public policy, the criminologist James Q. Wilson arrived at this core truth. At root, in almost every area of public concern, we are seeking to induce persons to act virtuously whether as school children, applicants for public assistance, would-be lawbreakers, or voters and public officials. On his wall, Harold had tacked another quotation from Benjamin Disraeli. The spiritual nature of man is stronger than codes or constitutions. No government can endure, which does not recognize that for its foundation, and no legislation last, which does not flow from this foundation. Everything came down to character, and that meant everything came down to the quality of relationships, because relationships are the seedbeds of character. The reason life and politics are so hard is that relationships are the most important, but also the most difficult things to understand. In short, Harold entered a public policy world in which people were used to thinking in hard, mechanistic terms. He thought he could do some good if he threw emotional and social perspectives into the mix. Socialism. As Harold worked his way through the process of discovering how his basic suppositions applied to the world of politics and policy, he came to lament the fact that the word socialism was already taken. The 19th and 20th century thinkers who had called themselves socialists weren't really socialists. They were statists. They valued the state over society. But true socialism would put social life first. He imagined that the cognitive revolution could foster more communitarian styles of politics. There would be a focus on the economic community. Did people in different classes have a sense they were joined in a common enterprise, or were the gaps between classes too wide? There would be a focus on the common culture. Were the core values of the society expressed and self-confidently reinforced? Were they reflected in the nation's institutions? Did new immigrants successfully assimilate? In the political sphere, Harold imagined, conservatives would emphasize that it is hard for the state to change culture and character. Liberals would argue that we still, in pragmatic ways, have to try. Both would speak the language of fraternity and inspire with a sense that we are all in this together. Harold didn't really know whether he should call himself a liberal or a conservative at this point. One of his guiding principles was drawn from a famous quotation from Daniel Patrick Moynihan. The central conservative truth is that it is culture, not politics, that determines the success of a society. The central liberal truth is that politics can change a culture and save it from itself. He did know that his job in Washington was to show the locals that character and culture really shape behavior, and that government could, in limited ways, shape culture and character. State power is like fire, warming when contained, fatal when it grows too large. In his view, government should not run people's lives. That only weakens the responsibility and virtue of the citizens. But government could influence the setting in which lives are lived. Government could, to some extent, nurture settings that serve as nurseries for fraternal relationships. It could influence the spirit of the citizenry. Part of that is done simply by performing the elemental tasks of the state, establishing a basic framework of order and security, defending against external attack, regulating economic activity to punish predators, protecting property rights, punishing crime, upholding rule of law, providing a basic level of social insurance and civic order. Some of this is done by reducing the programs that weaken culture and character. The social fabric is based on the idea that effort leads to reward. But very often, government rewards people who have not put in the effort. It does this with good intentions, the old welfare programs that discouraged work, and it does it with venal intentions. Lobbyists secure earmarks, tax breaks, and subsidies, so their companies can secure revenue without having to earn it in the marketplace. These programs weaken social trust and public confidence. By separating effort from reward, they pollute the atmosphere. They send the message that the system is rigged and society is corrupt. But Harold thought government, properly led, could also play a more constructive role. Just as remote and centralized power creates a servile citizenry, decentralized power and community self-government creates an active and cooperative citizenry. Infrastructure projects that create downtown hubs strengthen relationships and spur development. Charter schools bring parents together. Universities that are active beyond campus become civic and entrepreneurial hotspots. National service programs bring people together across class lines. Publicly funded, locally administered social entrepreneurship funds encourage civic activism and community service programs. Simple and fair tax policies rouse energies, increase dynamism, lift the animal spirits, and encourage creative destruction. Aristotle wrote that legislators habituate citizens. Whether they mean to or not, legislators encourage certain ways of living and discourage other ways. Statecraft is inevitably soulcraft. Experiments in Thinking. Harold began writing a series of essays for policy journals on what his soft side approach might mean in the real world. All his essays had a common theme: how the fracturing of unconscious bonds was at the root of many social problems, and how government could act to repair this tear in the social fabric. He began in areas as far removed as possible from the gushy world of emotion and relationships. His first essay was about global terrorism. Many commentators had originally assumed that terrorism was a product of poverty and a lack of economic opportunity. It was a problem with material roots. But research into the backgrounds of terrorists established that, according to one database, 75% of the anti-Western terrorists came from middle-class homes, and an amazing 63% had attended some college. The problem is not material, but social. The terrorists are, as Olivier Roy argues, detached from any specific country and culture. They are often caught in the no-man's land between the ancient and modern. They invent a make-believe ancient purity to give their lives meaning. They take up violent jihad because it attaches them to something. They are generally not politically active before they join terror groups, but are looking for some larger creed to give their existence shape and purpose. That choice can only be prevented if there are other causes to give them a different route to fulfillment. Then Harold wrote about military strategy, the essence of guns and mayhem, machismo. Harold described how military officers in Iraq and Afghanistan had found that it was impossible to defeat an insurgency on the battlefield by simply killing as many of the bad guys as possible. The only route to victory, they had learned, was through a counterinsurgency strategy called COIN, which started with winning the trust of the population. The soldiers and Marines discovered that it was not enough to secure a village. They had to hold it so that people could feel safe. They had to build schools, medical facilities, courts, and irrigation ditches. They had to reconvene town councils and give power to village elders. It was only when this nation-building activity was well along that the local societies would be strong enough and cohesive enough to help them provide intelligence about and repel the enemy. Harold pointed out that the hardest political activity, warfare, depended on the softest social skills: listening, understanding, and building trust. Victory in this kind of war is not about piling up dead bodies. It is about building communities. His next essay was about global AIDS policy. The West had thrown great technical knowledge at this problem and produced drugs that could help treat this plague. But the effectiveness of these drugs was limited if people continued to engage in the behaviors that lead to the disease. Harold pointed out that technical knowledge alone would not change behavior. Raising awareness is necessary, but insufficient. Surveys show that vast majorities in the most severely afflicted countries understand the dangers of HIV, but they behave in risky ways anyway. Providing condoms is necessary but insufficient. Most people in these countries have access to condoms, but that doesn't mean they actually use them, as rising or stable infection rates demonstrate. Economic development, too, is necessary but insufficient. The people who most aggressively spread the disease, often miners or truck drivers, are relatively well off. Providing health care facilities is also necessary but insufficient. Harold described a hospital in Namibia where 858 women were receiving treatments. After a year of effort, they could get only 5 of their male partners to come in for testing. Though it meant a death sentence, the men would not come to the hospital. In their culture, men did not go near hospitals. Harold visited a village in Namibia where all the middle-aged people were dead from AIDS. The children had nursed their parents into their graves. And yet, against all the most primal incentives of survival, the children were replicating the exact same behaviors that had led to their parents' deaths. He pointed out that the cause of this behavior defied all logic, as well as the principle of rational self-interest as commonly understood. The programs that actually changed behavior did not focus primarily upon logic and self-interest. The programs that worked best tried to change an entire pattern of life. They didn't merely try to change decisions about safe sex. They tried to create virtuous people who would not put themselves in the path of temptation. These programs were often led by religious leaders. These men and women spoke in the language of right and wrong, of vice and virtue. The people leading these programs spoke the language of ought. They talked about salvation and biblical truth, and safer sexual activity was a byproduct of a much larger change in outlook. This is a language unaddressed by technical knowledge. It's a language that has to be spoken by an elder, a neighbor, by people who know one another's names. Harold pointed out that the West has thrown a tremendous amount of medical and technical knowledge at the HIV/AIDS problem, but not enough moral and cultural knowledge, the kind of knowledge that changes lives, viewpoints, and morality, and through those larger patterns alters the unconscious basis of behavior. Then Harold got closer to home. He described how suburbia had strained community bonds across modern America. He pointed out that in the 1990s, developers built vast exurban housing developments. In those days, if you asked homebuyers what they wanted in their development, they said a golf course, the sign of status. But if a decade later you asked people what they wanted, they said a community center, a coffee shop, a hiking trail, and a health club. These folks had overshot the mark. They moved out to far-flung suburbs to get their piece of the American dream, which they equated with big property. But they missed the social connections that come from living in more densely populated areas. So the market had partially responded, with pseudo-urban streetscapes in the middle of the sprawl, dense downtown areas where people could stroll and eat at sidewalk cafes. Social mobility. Harold's biggest research project was about social mobility. His basic premise was that over the past few decades, scholars had spent too much time thinking about globalization, the movement of goods and ideas across borders. Globalization, he thought, was not the central process driving change. For example, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, offshore outsourcing was responsible for only 1.9% of layoffs in the first decade of the 21st century, despite all the talk and attention. According to Pankaj Ghemawat of Harvard Business School, 90% of fixed investment around the world is domestic. The real engine of change, Harold believed, was a change in the cognitive load. Over the past few decades, technological and social revolution had put greater and greater demands on human cognition. People are now compelled to absorb and process a much more complicated array of information streams. They are compelled to navigate much more complicated social environments. This is happening in both localized and globalized sectors, and it would be happening if you tore up every free trade deal ever inked. The globalization paradigm emphasizes the fact that information can travel 15,000 miles in an instant. But the cognitive load paradigm holds that the most important part of the journey is the last few inches, the space between a person's eyes or ears and the various regions of the brain. Through what sort of lens does the individual perceive the information? Does the individual have the capacity to understand the information? Does he or she have the training to exploit it? What emotions and ideas does the information set off? Are there cultural assumptions that distort or enhance the way it is understood? This change in the cognitive load has had many broad effects. It has changed the role of women, who are able to compete equally in the arena of mental skill. It has changed the nature of marriage, as men and women look for partners who can match and complement each other's mental abilities. It has led to assortative mating, as highly educated people marry each other and less educated people marry each other. It has also produced widening inequality, so that societies divide into two nations, a nation of those who possess the unconscious skills to navigate this terrain, and a nation of those who have not had the opportunity to acquire those skills. Over the past decades, there has been a steady rise in the education premium, the economic rewards that go to people with more education. In the 1970s, it barely made economic sense to go to college, some argued. There wasn't a big difference in the income levels of college grads and non-college grads. But starting in the early 1980s, the education premium started to grow, and it hasn't stopped. Today, money follows ideas. The median American with a graduate degree is part of a family making $93,000 a year. The median person with a college degree is in a family making $75,000. The median person with a high school degree is in a family making $42,000. And the average high school dropout is in a family making $28,000. Moreover, there is a superstar effect, even at the top. People who possess unique mental abilities become prized. Their salaries soar. People with decent education but fungible mental traits become commodities. Their salaries trudge slowly upward or even stagnate. These mental abilities tend to get passed down in families, and so you get an inherited meritocracy. It doesn't matter as much as it did in the 1950s whether you were born into an old Protestant family whose ancestors came over on the Mayflower, but it still matters a great deal what family you were born into, maybe more than ever. A child born into a family making $90,000 has a 50% chance of graduation from college by age 24. A child born into a family making $70,000 has a 1 in 4 chance. A child born into a family making $45,000 has a 1 in 10 chance. A child born into a family making $30,000 has a 1 in 17 chance. Elite universities become bastions of privilege. Anthony Carnevale and Stephen Rose surveyed the top 146 U.S. colleges and found that only 3% of the students there came from families in the bottom economic quartile. 74% of students came from families in the top quartile. A healthy society is a mobile society, one in which everybody has a shot at the good life, in which everybody has reason to strive, in which people rise and fall according to their deserts. But societies in the cognitive age produce their own form of inequality, lodged deep in the brains of the citizenry, which is more subtle than ancient class distinctions under feudalism, but nearly as stark and unfair. Harold pointed out that most nations have tried to battle this problem, spending a lot of money in the process. The United States has spent over $1 trillion to try to reduce the achievement gap between white and black students. Public education spending per pupil increased by 240% in real terms between 1960 and 2000. Major universities offer lavish aid packages, and some of the richest, like Harvard, waive tuition entirely for those from families making less than $60,000 a year. The United States spends enough money on anti-poverty programs to hand every person in poverty a check for $15,000 a year. A mother with two kids would get a $45,000 check every year if the programs were converted into a simple transfer. But money can't solve the problem of inequality because money is not the crucial source of the problem. The problem is in the realm of conscious and unconscious development. Harold needed only to compare his upbringing to Erica's to see this. Some children are bathed in an atmosphere that encourages human capital development. Books, discussion, reading, questions, conversations about what they want to do in the future. And some children are bathed in a disrupted atmosphere. If you read part of a story to kindergarten children in an affluent neighborhood, about half of them will be able to predict what will happen next in the story. If you read the same fragment to children in poor neighborhoods, only about 10% will be able to anticipate the flow of events. The ability to construct templates about the future is vitally important to future success. In 1964, before the cognitive age had truly kicked in, rich families and poor families were demographically similar, which meant that children up and down the income scale began adulthood with similar outlooks and capacities. But as more and more demands were put on mental processing, gaps opened up, and more educated children grow up in different landscapes than less educated children. More educated children live amidst virtuous feedback loops. High skills and stable families lead to economic success, which makes stable family life easier, which makes skill acquisition and future economic success easier. Less educated children live amidst vicious feedback loops. Low skills and family breakdown leads to economic stress, which makes family breakdown even more likely, which makes skill acquisition and economic security even harder to achieve. Today, college-educated and non-college-educated people inhabit different landscapes. Over two-thirds of middle-class children are raised in intact two-parent families, while less than a third of poor children are raised in them. About half the students in community colleges have either been pregnant or gotten somebody pregnant. Isabel Sawhill has calculated that if family structures were the same today as they were in 1970, then the poverty rate would be roughly one-quarter lower than it is today. Vast attitudinal gaps have opened up as well. As Robert Putnam has shown, college-educated people are much more likely to trust the people around them. They are much more likely to believe they can control their own destinies and to take actions in order to achieve their goals. People on both sides of the divide tend to want the same things. The highly educated and the less educated tend to want to live in stable two-parent homes. They tend to want to earn college degrees and have their children surpass them. It's just that the more educated have more emotional resources to actually execute these visions. If you get married before having children, graduate from high school, and work full-time, there is a 98% chance that you will not live in poverty. But many people are unable to achieve these things. As Harold conducted his research on poverty, family disruption, and other issues related to social mobility, he sometimes wanted to just shake people and tell them to get their act together, show up for the job interview, take the SAT test you registered for, study for the final so you can graduate from college. Don't quit your job just because it's boring or because you've got a minor crisis at home. He knew that at some level there is no substitute for individual responsibility and no prospect for success unless people are held accountable for their decisions and work relentlessly to achieve their goals. On the other hand, he knew it was no good to just give bootstrap sermons. Flourishing depends on unconscious skills that serve as a prerequisite for conscious accomplishments. People who haven't acquired those unconscious skills find it much harder to fall into a workday routine and trudge off to a job each morning, even if they don't really feel like it. It will be harder for them to be polite toward a boss who drives them crazy, to smile openly when they meet a new person, to present a consistent face to the world, even as they go through different moods and personal crises. They'll find it hard to develop a fundamental faith in self-efficacy, a belief that they can shape the course of their life. They'll be less likely to have confidence in the proposition that cause leads to effect, that if they sacrifice now, something good will result. Then there are the psychic effects of inequality itself. In their book, The Spirit Level, Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett argue that the mere fact of being low on the status totem pole brings its own deep stress and imposes its own psychic costs. Inequality and a feeling of exclusion causes social pain, which leads to more obesity, worse health outcomes, fewer social connections, more depression and anxiety. Wilkinson and Pickett point, for example, to a study of British civil servants. Some of the civil servants had high-status, high-pressure jobs. Others had low-status, low-pressure jobs. You'd think the people in the high-pressure jobs would have higher rates of heart disease, gastrointestinal disease, and general sickness. In fact, it was the people in the low-pressure jobs. Low status imposes its own costs. With his soft side approach, Harold put his faith in programs that reshaped the internal models in people's minds. If you felt, as Harold did, that in some low-income communities achievement values were not being transmitted from one generation to another, then you had no choice but to try to instill them. That meant you had to be somewhat paternalistic. If parents were not instilling these achievement values, then churches and charity groups should try. If those institutions were overwhelmed, then government should try to step in to help people achieve the three things they need to enter the middle class: marriage, a high school degree, and a job. All of us need to be prodded to do things that will improve our long-term well-being, whether it is eating the right foods or setting aside funds for retirement, Ron Haskins and Isabel Sawhill write in their book, Creating an Opportunity Society. Low-income families are no different. There was no single policy that could build these unconscious skills. Human capital policies are like nutrition. You have to instill them constantly. But Harold did see a sequence of policies that could help those who are cut off from the social mobility ladder. The biggest impact comes from focusing on the young. As James Heckman argues, learners learn and skill begets skill. So investments in children have much bigger payoffs than investments in people who are older. Parenting classes teach teenage moms how to care for their children. Nurse home visits help provide structure for disorganized families and provide on-the-job pointers for young mothers. Quality early education programs have lasting effects on childhood development. Sometimes the IQ gains fade away as children from quality preschools enter the regular school population. But social and emotional skills do not seem to fade away, and those produce lasting gains, higher graduation rates, and better career outcomes. Integrated neighborhood approaches like the Harlem Children's Zone produce the most impressive results. These programs offer a deluge of different programs, all designed to put young people into a high-achieving counterculture. KIPP academies and other no-nonsense schools significantly improve their students' prospects. These schools, like the one Erica attended, give students a whole new way of living, much more disciplined and rigorous than they are used to. The most important thing about any classroom is the relationship between a teacher and a student. Small classes may be better, but it's better to have a good teacher in a big class than a bad teacher in a small class. Merit pay for teachers should help keep talented teachers in the classroom. Students learn best from someone they love. Mentoring programs also create relationships. Students are much less likely to drop out of high school or college if they have an important person in their life guiding them and encouraging them day by day. The City University of New York has a program called ASAP, which has an intensive mentoring component and seems to increase graduation rates. The first generation of human capital policies gave people access to schools, colleges, and training facilities. Second generation policies would have to help them develop the habits, knowledge, and mental traits they needed to succeed there. It's not enough to give a student the chance to go to a community college if, once she gets there, she finds the requirements confusing, the guidance counselors rude and unavailable, the registration process baffling, the important courses already full, and the graduation requirements mysterious. These obstacles defeat students lacking social capital. Second-generation human capital policies have to pay attention to the hidden curriculum of life, as much as to the overt one. A nation of grinders. The more time Harold spent thinking about politics and trying to form a governing philosophy, the more he realized that personal development and social mobility were at the heart of his vision of a great society. Social mobility opens up horizons because people can see wider opportunities and transformed lives. Social mobility reduces class conflict because no one is sentenced to spend their days in the caste into which they were born. Social mobility unleashes creative energies. It mitigates inequality because no station need be permanent. Harold found himself in a nation with two dominant political movements. There was a liberal movement that believed in using government to enhance equality. There was a conservative movement that believed in limited government to enhance freedom. But historically, there once had been another movement that believed in limited but energetic government to enhance social mobility. This movement had its start on a small Caribbean island a few hundred years ago. In the 18th century, there was a little boy who lived on the island of St. Croix, in the Caribbean. His father abandoned him when he was 10. His mother died in the bed next to him when he was 12. He was adopted by a cousin, who promptly committed suicide. His remaining family consisted of an aunt, an uncle, and a grandmother. They all died within a few years. A probate court came in and confiscated the small bit of property he had inherited from his mother. He and his brother were left destitute, orphaned, and alone. By 17, Alexander Hamilton was managing a trading firm. By 24, he was George Washington's chief of staff and a war hero. By 34, he had written 51 essays of the Federalist Papers and was New York's most successful lawyer. By 40, he was stepping down as the most successful Treasury Secretary in American history. Hamilton created a political tradition designed to help young strivers like himself. He hoped to create a nation where young, ambitious people could make full use of their talents and where their labors would build a great nation. Every new scene, which is opened to the busy nature of man to rouse and exert itself, is the addition of a new energy to the general stock of effort. Rouse, exert, energy. These are Hamiltonian words. He promoted policies designed to nurture this dynamism. At a time when many people were suspicious of manufacturing and believed that only agriculture produced virtue and wealth, Hamilton championed industry and technological change. At a time when traders and financial markets were disdained by the plantation oligarchy, Hamilton promoted vibrant capital markets to stir the nation. At a time when the economy was broken into local fiefdoms run by big landowners, Hamilton sought to smash local monopolies and open opportunity. He nationalized the Revolutionary War debt, creating capital markets and binding the nation's economy into one more competitive exchange. He believed in using government to enhance market dynamism by fostering competition. The Hamiltonian tradition was carried on in the early 19th century by Henry Clay and the Whig Party, which championed canals and railroads and other internal improvements to open up opportunity and bind the nation. That cause was taken up by a young Whig, Abraham Lincoln. Like Hamilton, Lincoln had grown up in a poor family and was fired by an ambition that knew no rest. But Lincoln gave more speeches about labor and economics than he did about slavery, and sought to create a nation that would welcome self-transformation and embrace the gospel of work. "I hold the value of life is to improve one's condition," he told an audience of immigrants in 1861. Under his leadership, the Civil War-era government unified the currency, passed the Homestead Act, the Land-Grant College Act, and railroad legislation. These policies were designed to give Americans an open field and a fair chance to spread the spirit of enterprise, enhance social mobility, and so build the nation. The next great figure in this tradition was Theodore Roosevelt. He, too, believed in the character-building force of competition, its ability to produce people who possessed the vigorous virtues he lauded in his 1905 inaugural address, energy, self-reliance, and initiative. Roosevelt, too, believed that government must sometimes play an active role in encouraging the strenuous life and giving everyone a fair chance in the race. "The true function of the state, as it interferes in social life," he wrote, "should be to make the chances of competition more even, not to abolish them." This Hamiltonian tradition dominated American politics for many decades, but in the 20th century it faded. The big debate of the 20th century was over the size of government. The Hamiltonian tradition sat crosswise to that debate. But Harold came to believe it was time to revive that limited but energetic government tradition, with two updates. Hamiltonians of the past lived before the dawning of the cognitive age, when the mental demands on young strivers were relatively low. That situation had changed. And so a movement that sought to enhance social mobility would have to handle the more complicated social and information environments. Furthermore, Hamilton, Lincoln, and Roosevelt had been able to assume a level of social and moral capital. They took it for granted that citizens lived in tight communities defined by well-understood norms, a moral consensus, and restrictive customs. Today's leaders could not make that assumption. The moral and social capital present during those years had eroded and needed to be rebuilt. Harold spent his years in Washington championing a Hamiltonian approach that offered second-generation human capital policies. He never developed what you might call an ideology, an all-explaining system of good government. The world was too complex an organism for that, too filled with a hidden tangle of latent functions for some hyper-confident government to come in and reshape according to some prefab plan. Nor did he have a heroic vision of political leadership. Harold had a more constrained image of what government can and should do. The British philosopher Michael Oakeshott was issuing a useful warning against hubris when he wrote, "In political activity, then, men sail a boundless and bottomless sea. There is neither harbor for shelter, nor floor for anchorage, neither starting place nor appointed destination. The enterprise is to keep afloat on an even keel. The sea is both friend and enemy, and the seamanship consists in using the resources of a traditional manner of behavior in order to make a friend of every hostile occasion." When thinking about government, Harold tried to remind himself how little we know and can know, how much our own desire for power and to do good blinds us to our own limitations. But he did, like most Americans, believe in progress. Thus, while he had an instinctive aversion to change that alters the fundamental character of society, he had an affection for reform that repairs it. He spent those years writing his essays, peppering the world with his policy proposals. Not many people seemed to agree with him. There was a New York Times columnist whose views were remarkably similar to his own, and a few others. Still, he plugged away, feeling that he was mostly right about things, and that someday others would reach the conclusions he had reached. Karl Marx once said that Milton wrote Paradise Lost the way a silkworm produces silk, as the unfolding of his very nature. Harold felt fulfilled during his think tank years. He wasn't always happy when Erica would disappear for weeks at a time, but he felt he was making some contribution to the world. He was confident that his socialist approach, in one guise or another, would someday have a large impact on the world. Chapter 21. The Other Education. Every winter, the great and the good meet in Davos, Switzerland, for the World Economic Forum. And every night during that week at Davos, there are constellations of parties. The people in the outer ring parties envy the people in the mid-ring parties, and the people in the mid-ring wish they were invited to the ones in the inner ring. Each ring features a slightly more elevated guest list than the last, with economists and knowledgeable people on the outside, and ascending levels of power, fame, and lack of expertise toward the center. At the molten core of the party constellation, there is always one party that forms the social holy of the holies, where former presidents, cabinet secretaries, central bankers, global tycoons, and Angelina Jolie gather to mingle and schmooze. And this party is without question the dullest in the whole constellation. The Davos social universe, like social universes everywhere, consists of rings of interesting and insecure people desperately seeking entry into the realm of the placid and self-satisfied. After a few decades of business success and 8 years of ever more prominent public service, as deputy chief of staff during the first Grace term and commerce secretary in the second, Erica had gained entry to the Davos epicenter. She was the sort who got invited to all the most exclusive and boring parties. In retirement, she now served on worthy commissions on intractable problems: deficit spending, nuclear proliferation, the transatlantic alliance, and the future of global trade agreements. She was not one of those people whose face lights up at the sound of the words plenary session, but she had become a battle-hardened summiteer, able to withstand barrages of eminent tedium. She had become friends or acquaintances with the former world leaders who also sat on these commissions and who traveled during the year from Davos to Jackson Hole, to Tokyo and beyond, to express grave concern about the looming crises that people still in power were too short-sighted to solve. At first, Erica had been anxious and self-conscious when chatting with former presidents and global celebrities, but the awe fell away pretty quickly. And now it was just like the same old knitting circle gathered once again at a different world resort. One former minister had resigned in disgrace. A president had been a complete flop in office. A former secretary of state had been gracelessly pushed from power. Everybody's sore spots were avoided, and all was forgiven in the rough and tumble world they had endured. And as for their conversation, well, it was a conspiracy buff's worst nightmare. It transpires that when the people in charge of the world's great institutions get together, what they really want to talk about is golf, jet lag remedies, and gallstones. The days were consumed with portentous concern over the threat of rising protectionism, and the nights by intense stories about prostates. The meetings operated on what was called the Chatham House Rule, which meant that nobody was permitted to say anything interesting. The highlight of the nightly conversations was the occasional tale of backroom idiocy. Former world leaders inevitably have a repertoire of backroom stories that they use to entertain people at dinner parties. One former president told the story of the time he made the mistake of bragging about his dog to Russian leader Vladimir Putin. During the next Moscow summit, Putin entered at lunch with four Rottweilers and bragged, "Bigger, faster, and stronger than yours." That led a former national security advisor to tell the story of the time Putin stole his ring. He'd been wearing his West Point graduation ring at a meeting. Putin asked to see it and put it on his own finger, and then deftly slipped it into his pocket while they were talking. The State Department raised a ruckus trying to get it back, but Putin wouldn't give. Another prime minister told of the time he snuck out of a cocktail party at Buckingham Palace to snoop around the private quarters and got caught and screamed at by the Queen. Stories like those were always delicious and left the impression that world affairs are controlled by third graders. Erica nonetheless enjoyed this whirl. She thought the commissions did some good, despite their insipidness, and she enjoyed her continued glimpses into the inner workings of world affairs. She often would sit back in the middle of some long meeting and wonder how it was that these men and women had risen to the top of the global elite. They weren't marked by exceptional genius. They did not have extraordinarily deep knowledge or creative opinions. If there was one trait the best of them possessed, it was a talent for simplification. They had the ability to take a complex situation and capture the heart of the matter in simple terms. A second after they located the core fact of any problem, their observation seemed blindingly obvious, but somehow nobody had simplified the issue in quite those terms beforehand. They took reality and made it manageable for busy people. As for herself, Erica had reached a status plateau. She had reached a certain eminence. She was treated as a significant person wherever she went. Strangers would approach and say they were honored to meet her. This didn't make her feel happy by itself, but it did mean that she was no longer gnawed by the sort of ambition anxiety that had driven her through much of her life. Recognition and wealth, she had learned, do not produce happiness, but they do liberate you from the worries that plague people who lack but desire these things. In outer appearance, Erica still thought of herself as the pushy young girl. She experienced those moments of shock when she came upon her own face unexpectedly in the mirror and was stunned to find it was not the face of a 22-year-old woman. It was the face of an older woman. Now she had trouble hearing women with high voices, and she had trouble hearing anyone at loud parties. She sometimes could not get out of low chairs without pushing herself up with her arms. Her teeth were darker than before, and her gums had shrunk, leaving more of her teeth exposed. She had shifted to softer foods. The muscles around the jaw lose 40% of their mass over the course of a normal life. In addition, she had begun holding the handrails when she descended a staircase. She heard stories of more elderly friends who had fallen and broken hips. Of those who do, 40% end up in a nursing home, and 20% never walk again. She had also begun taking an array of pills each day, and had broken down and bought one of those pill organizers. Culturally, Erica felt mildly out of it. There were now a couple of generations of young movie starlets who she could not tell apart. Pop music trends had come and gone without really attracting her notice. On the other hand, Erica felt that in her later years she had arrived at a more realistic appraisal of herself. It was as if she had achieved such a level of worldly security that she now could look realistically at her shortcomings. In this way, success had brought a humility that she had never felt before. She had read the books and plays that treated old age as a remorseless slide into decrepitude. In As You Like It, Shakespeare's morose character Jaques calls old age second childishness and mere oblivion. In the middle of the 20th century, developmental psychologists, when they treated old age at all, often regarded it as a period of withdrawal. The elderly slowly separate themselves from the world, it was believed, in preparation for death. They cannot be expected to achieve new transformations. About the age of 50, Freud wrote, the elasticity of the mental processes on which treatment depends is, as a rule, lacking. Old people are no longer educable. But Erica did not feel any of that. And indeed, more recent research has shown that seniors are completely capable of learning and growth. The brain is capable of creating new connections and even new neurons all through life. While some mental processes, like working memory, the ability to ignore distractions, and the ability to quickly solve math problems, clearly deteriorate, others do not. While many neurons die and many connections between different regions of the brain wither, older people's brains reorganize to help compensate for the effects of aging. Older brains might take longer to produce the same results, but they do tend to get the problems solved. One study of air traffic controllers found that 30-year-olds had better memories than their older colleagues, but 60-year-olds did just as well in emergency situations. A series of longitudinal studies begun decades ago are producing a rosier portrait of life after retirement. These studies don't portray old age as surrender or even serenity. They portray it as a period of development, and they are not even talking about uber-oldsters who take their coming mortality as a sign they should start parachuting out of airplanes. Most people report being happier as they get older. This could be because as people age, they pay less attention to negative emotional stimuli. Laura Carstensen of Stanford has found that older people are better able to keep their emotions in balance and bounce back more quickly from negative events. John Gabrielli of MIT has found that in older people's brains, the amygdala remains active when people are viewing positive images, but is not active when people are viewing negative images. They've unconsciously learned the power of positive perception. Gender roles begin to merge as people age. Many women get more assertive, while many men get more emotionally attuned. Personalities often become more vivid as people become more of what they already are. Norma Hahn of Berkeley conducted a 50-year follow-up of people who had been studied while young and concluded that the subjects had become more outgoing, self-confident, and warm with age. There's no evidence to suggest that people get automatically wiser as they get older. The tests, such as they are, that try to assess wisdom, a combination of social, emotional, and informational knowledge, suggest a kind of plateau. People achieve a level of competence on these tests in middle age, which holds steady until about age 75. But wisdom is the sort of quality that eludes paper and pencil tests, and Erica felt that she possessed skills in pseudo-retirement that she did not possess even in middle age. She felt she had a better ability to look at problems from different perspectives. She felt she was better at observing a situation without leaping to conclusions. She felt she was better at being able to distinguish between tentative beliefs and firm conclusions. That is to say, she was better able to accurately see the ocean of her own mind. There was one thing she didn't experience much, a sense of being vividly alive. In the early days of her career, she'd be flown out to some Los Angeles hotel, put up in a suite by the client, and walk around the rooms giggling at the grandeur of it all. In those days, she would book an extra day in nearly every city she visited to experience the museums and the historic sites. She could remember those solitary walks around the Getty or the Frick, and the feeling of being transported by art. She remembered the special energy of her exalted moods, a night spent getting lost in Venice with a novel under her arm, or touring the old mansions in Charleston. Somehow, that didn't happen anymore. She no longer booked the extra sightseeing days at the end of her trips. There was no time. As her career got more demanding, her cultural activities got less so. Her poetic, artistic, and theatrical tastes had dropped from highbrow to middlebrow and below. By the time we reach age 50, University of Pennsylvania neuroscientist Andrew B. Newberg has written, we are less likely to elicit the kinds of peak or transcendent experiences that can occur when we are young. Instead, we are more inclined to have subtle spiritual experiences and refinements of our basic belief. In addition, Erica's work had dragged her in a prosaic direction. She had a great talent for organization and execution. This had pulled her, over the course of her life, to become a CEO and a government official. It had pulled her into the world of process. The number of her acquaintances multiplied over the years as the number of her true friendships diminished. The Grant longitudinal study found that people who were neglected in childhood are much more likely to be friendless in old age. In this way, the working models submerge and then surface through life. Erica was not solitary, but sometimes she felt she lived in crowded solitude. She was around a shifting mass of semi-friends, but was without a small circle of intimates. Over the years, in other words, she had become more superficial. She had been publicly active, but privately neglectful. She had, over the course of her career, reorganized her own brain in ways that were perhaps necessary to professional achievement, but which were not satisfying, now that her drive for worldly achievement had been fulfilled. She entered retirement beset by a feeling of general numbness. It was as if there was a great battle she had never noticed before. A battle between the forces of shallowness and the forces of profundity. Over the years, the forces of shallowness had staged a steady advance. And then, of course, the River Styx was coming into view. Death, pegging out, the final frontier. Erica did not think this would happen to her or Harold any time soon. Surely not. They were too healthy. They each could point to relatives who had lived into their 90s, though of course in reality such comforting correlations mean almost nothing. Nonetheless, her older acquaintances were dying at a regular rate. She could, if she chose, go on the internet and find her morbidity odds. 1 in 5 women her age gets cancer. 1 in 6 gets heart disease. 1 in 7 diabetes. It was a little like living in wartime. Every few weeks, another member of her social platoon was gone. The effect was both terrorizing and energizing. She seemed to live permanently in a state of mixed emotions. The rushing presence of death changed her perception of time. Slowly, a challenge formed in Erica's mind. Retirement would liberate her from the forces of shallowness. She could design her own neural diet, the influences and things that would flow into her brain. She could turn to deeper things. Now she could embark on a glorious lark. Being Erica, she had to write out a business plan for herself. In the final chapter of her life, she wanted to live more vividly. She took out a legal pad and wrote a list of different spheres of her life: reflection, creativity, community, intimacy, and service. Under each category, she wrote down a list of activities she could pursue. She would like to write a short memoir. She'd like to master some new art form, to do something difficult and achieve some competence. She'd like to be a member of a circle of girlfriends who could come together every year to laugh and drink and share. She would like to find some way to teach the young. She'd like to learn the names of the trees so that when she walked through a forest, she would know what she was seeing. She'd like to strip away the bullshit and find out whether or not she believed in God. Mindfulness. In the first months of retirement, she had an urge to reconnect with old friends. She had not kept in touch with anyone from the academy, and almost all of her friends from college had fallen away as well. But Facebook allowed her to remedy all that, and within weeks she was happily exchanging emails with friends from decades gone by. Renewing these old friendships gave her pleasure beyond all reckoning. These contacts aroused parts of her own nature that had lain dormant. She discovered that one of her old college roommates, a southern woman named Missy, lived not 25 miles away from her, and one day they arranged to have lunch. Erica and Missy had lived together in their junior year, and though they shared a room, they had not grown particularly close. Erica was frantically busy in those days, and Missy, a pre-med student, had spent all her time in the library. Missy was still thin and tiny. Her hair had gone gray, but her skin was still smooth. She'd become an eye surgeon, had a family, recovered from a double mastectomy, and had retired a few years ahead of Erica. During lunch, Missy excitedly described the passion that had transformed her life over the past few years: mindfulness meditation. Erica felt her stomach drop, expecting to hear stories of yogis, spiritual retreats at ashrams in India, and Missy resplendently getting in touch with her inner core, the normal New Age rigmarole. Missy had been the hardened scientist at school, and now she'd apparently gone to mush. But Missy talked about her meditations the way she used to talk about her homework assignments, with the same cool rigor. "I sit cross-legged and upright on the floor," Missy was saying, At first, I concentrate on my breathing, anticipating the exhaling and inhaling, and then feeling my body fulfilling my anticipations. I feel my nostrils open and close, and my chest rise and fall. Then I center my thoughts on a word or phrase. I don't repeat it over and over again. I just keep it in the front of my mind. And if I find my thoughts wandering, I bring them back. Some people pick Jesus, or God, or Buddha, or Adonai. But I just picked diving within. Then I watch to see what feelings and perceptions and images flow into my brain, letting the experience unfold naturally. It's like sitting still as various thoughts emerge into consciousness. Often, in the beginning, I lose focus. I find myself thinking about my chores or the emails I have to answer. That's when I repeat my phrase. After a little while, most of the time, the outside world begins to fade back into the shadows. I don't even have to repeat the phrase anymore. I don't know how to describe it. I begin to be aware of awareness. My identity, my I-ness, fades away, and I enter the sensations and feelings that are bubbling up from down below. The object is to welcome them non-judgmentally, without interpreting them. Just welcome them as friends. Welcome them with a smile. One of my teachers compares it to watching clouds drift into a valley. These puffs of awareness float by, and they are replaced by other puffs and other mental states. It's like having access to processes that are there all along, but are usually unseen. I'm not doing a good job of putting it into words, because the whole point is that it is beneath words. When I try to describe it, it seems so stale and conceptual. But when I'm in that state, there is no narrator. There's no interpreter. There are no words. I'm not really aware of time. I'm not telling myself a story about myself. The play-by-play announcer is gone. It's all sensations happening. Does that make any sense? Apparently, Missy had found a way to directly perceive level one. When I come out of the state, I'm changed. I see the world differently. Daniel Siegel says it's like you've been walking through a forest at night, shining a flashlight to light your way. Suddenly, you turn off the flashlight. You lose the bright beam of light on the narrow spot. But gradually, your eyes start to adjust to the darkness, and you can suddenly see the whole scene. I used to assume that my emotions were me. But now I sort of observe them rising and floating through me. You realize that things you thought were your identity are really just experiences. They are sensations that flow through you. You begin to see that your ordinary ways of perceiving are only a few vantage points among many. There are other ways of seeing. You develop what the Buddhists call beginner's mind. You see the world as a baby sees it, aware of everything all at once, without conscious selection and interpretation. Missy said all this briskly over a salad, spearing her asparagus. Her description of mindfulness meditation suggested that in fact it is possible, with the right training, to peer beneath the waterline of consciousness into the hidden kingdom. The normal conscious mind might see only colors in a small slice of the electromagnetic spectrum, but perhaps it was possible to widen the view and suddenly be able to see the rest of the actual world. In fact, neuroscientists, who are generally a hard-headed lot, have profound respect for these sorts of meditative practices. They've hosted the Dalai Lama at their conferences, and some of them make their way to monasteries in Tibet precisely because there is an overlap between the findings of the science and the practices of the monks. It's now clear that the visions and transcendent experiences that religious ecstatics have long described are not just fantasies. They're not just the misfirings caused by an epileptic seizure. Instead, humans seem to be equipped to experience the sacred, to have elevated moments when they transcend the normal boundaries of perceptions. Andrew Newberg found that when Tibetan monks or Catholic nuns enter a period of deep meditation or prayer, Their parietal lobes, the region of the brain that helps define the boundaries of our bodies, becomes less active. They experience a sensation of infinite space. Subsequent research found that Pentecostal worshippers undergo a different, though no less remarkable, brain transformation when they are speaking in tongues. Pentecostals do not have a sense of losing themselves in the universe. Their parietal lobes do not go dark. On the other hand, they do experience a decrease in memory functions and an increase in emotional and sensory activation. As Newberg writes, in the Pentecostal tradition, the goal is to be transformed by the experience. Rather than making old beliefs stronger, the individual is opening the mind in order to make new experiences more real. The different religious practices produce different brain states, each of which are consistent with the different theologies. Brain scans don't settle whether God exists or not because they don't tell you who designed these structures. They don't solve the great mystery, which is the mystery of consciousness, how emotion reshapes the matter in the brain, and how the matter in the brain creates spirit and emotion. But they do show that people who become expert at meditation and prayer rewire their brains. It is possible, by shifting attention inward, to peer deep into the traffic of the unconscious, achieving an integration of conscious and unconscious processes, which some people call wisdom. Missy glanced up from her salad from time to time, just to make sure Erica wasn't looking at her as if she were nuts. She was matter of fact, but also made clear how much these experiences meant to her. She kept apologizing for the inadequacies of her descriptions, her inability to really put into words what it felt like to perceive things holistically instead of deductively, and the feeling of expanded awareness. She wasn't sipping on some organic carrot shake while she was talking about all this. She hadn't gone all Yoko Ono. She was a surgeon, who still practiced part-time, who drove a gas-guzzling SUV and drank white wine with lunch. It's just that she had found a scientifically plausible way to access a deeper level of cognition. Toward the end of lunch, she asked Erica if she would like to come to her next session and try out this mindfulness meditation stuff. Erica heard her mouth saying, "No thanks, it's not really for me." She didn't know why she answered this way. The idea of peering directly inside herself filled her with a deep aversion. All her life she had been looking outward and trying to observe the world. Hers had been a life of motion, not tranquility. The fact is, she was afraid of looking directly inside. It was a pool of dark water she did not want to plunge into. If she was going to live more vividly, she'd have to find another way. The Second Education. Over the next several months, Erica became something of a culture vulture, diving into the world of the arts with a voracious hunger and her characteristic drive. She read some books on the history of Western painting. She bought some poetry anthologies and found herself reading them in bed before she drifted off to sleep. She bought a CD course in classical music and listened to it while driving in her car. She began going to museums again with friends. Like most people, life had given her one sort of education. She had gone to school. She had taken such and such management courses, worked her way through various jobs, and learned such and such skills. She had come to possess a certain professional expertise. But now she was beginning her second education. This education was an emotional one, about how and what to feel. This second education did not work like the first one. In the first education, the information to be mastered walked through the front door and announced itself by light of day. It was direct. There were teachers to describe the material to be covered, and then everybody worked through it. In the second education, there was no set curriculum or set of skills to be covered. Erica just wandered around looking for things she enjoyed. Learning was a byproduct of her search for pleasure. The information came to her indirectly, seeping through the cracks of the window panes, from under the floorboards, and through the vents of her mind. Erica read Sense and Sensibility, The Good Soldier, or Anna Karenina, and she would find herself moving with the characters, imitating their states of mind and discovering new emotional flavors. The novels, poems, paintings, and symphonies she consumed never applied directly to her life. Nobody was writing poems about retired CEOs, but what mattered most were the emotional sensations portrayed in them. In his book, Culture Counts, the philosopher Roger Scruton writes that the reader of Wordsworth's Prelude learns how to animate the natural world with pure hopes of his own. The spectator of Rembrandt's Night Watch learns of the pride of corporations and the benign sadness of civic life. The listener to Mozart's Jupiter Symphony is presented with the open floodgates of human joy and creativity. The reader of Proust is led through the enchanted world of childhood and made to understand the uncanny prophecy of our later griefs, which those days of joy contain. Even at her age, Erica was learning to perceive in new ways. Just as living in New York or China or Africa gives you a perspective from which to see the world, so, too, spending time in the world of a novelist inculcates its own preconscious viewpoint. Through trial and error, Erica discovered her tastes. She thought she loved the Impressionists, but now they left her strangely unmoved. Maybe their stuff was too familiar. On the other hand, she became enraptured by the color schemes of the Florentine Renaissance and Rembrandt's homely, knowing faces. Each of them tuned her mind, the instrument with a million strings. She had some moments of pure pleasure, when she could feel her heart beating faster and a quiver in her stomach, standing in front of a painting or discovering a new installation or poem. There was a time, reading Anthony Trollope of all people, when she could feel the emotions of the story in her own body and was alive to the sensations produced there. "Mine is no callous shell," Walt Whitman wrote about his body, and Erica was beginning to appreciate what he meant.